Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello. Welcome to the New Books Network. I am your host, Stephen Sakevich. In this episode, I will be talking with Dave Lepore on his book, Time Patterns in Big History, Cycles, Fractals, Waves, Transitions, and Singularities, independently published in 2020. Dave Lepore researches, develops, and applies science principles in environmental issues, big history, evolutionary trends, and particle scattering. He has over 30 years of experience at Argonne National Laboratory in the development of scientific analysis, software training, and model. Dave Lepore, welcome to the New Books Network.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Now, we usually like to begin our interviews by asking our guests, tell us a little something about yourself and the backstory behind writing this book.
Yeah, I have a background studying physics and computer science, but I've been mostly in environmental science work and some oil exploration, kind of applying some physics, nuclear and laser technology. But around 2002, I saw this paper in one of these journals by Theodore Modus, Technological Forecasting Social Change, kind of about this big trend in history. And it really fascinated me. I thought it was very bold. And I thought, well, what can I do? That led to a path for me getting involved in various things. First thing I looked at is a trend in physics discoveries, because that was a trend that seemed to be coming to an end at the end of the 19th century, but it slowed down after it reached its peak kind of in the 30s and 40s. And so I went on in big history and kind of interested in environment, energy, and technology. And I got involved with writing papers in big history. And then in 2020, I was involved with two books, this book that kind of I had been working on for like a decade, kind of compilation of various papers, and then a compendium of papers that I helped edit with Andrei Karteyev of Moscow State University. And in there, we looked at singularity trends and in big history. So that's kind of where I come from.
Yeah. Now, this is written in the field of what's called big history. Now, could you for any of our listeners who might not be familiar with the field, could you kind of give like a quick summary of what big history is all about? And we'll definitely go into more detail in the interview.
Yes. So David Christian kind of coined the term big history, but a lot of people have been looking at it kind of before and obviously after. But big history looks at a kind of integrated view of history. Kind of you can look at it as where we come from. And so it starts with the Big Bang about 13.7 billion years ago, the development of the universe, galaxies, stars, planets. And then it focuses in on Earth, because that's the only place right now that we know that there's life. Hopefully we'll find other places and have another point to add to our data. But then life evolved, originated and evolved on Earth. And then humans went undergone evolution, kind of in what was believed East Africa, then eventually civilizations occurred with large cities, kind of in the Mideast, India, China, and then later in the New World. So it's kind of the integrated study of this using the best evidence of, the cosmic life evolution, human evolution, and then, history, civilization evolution.
Yeah, you mentioned in your introductory remarks, Theodore Modi and his hypothesis of singularity. Can you explain this in a little more detail? Because many people, when they hear singularity, they think of certain things, but Modi, he's referring to a specific kind of phenomena, correct?
Yes. So it is this kind of acceleration of the speed of things. And others have looked at various parts of it. Ray Kurzweil and John Smart have looked at the technological parts of this, but this is more a much broader, longer scale. And looked at various events that people listed, including Carl Sagan, and kind of went through it. It does seem to be accelerating. I always point to the fact that, if you courses that you might have studied in high school or in college might have included astronomy and then biology and evolution of life. Anthropology and human evolution, and then various forms of history. And those periods, at least from those on Earth, Earth started about 4.5 billion years ago. So I kind of say, the last 5 billion years. The line that led to humans kind of broke from the line that led to chimpanzees about 5 million years ago. And civilization, in terms of writing and large cities, started about 5,000 years ago. And so you can kind of see, just based on some of the courses that people have taken, you can, think about those durations, 5 billion, 5 million, 5,000. The sequence is, 1/1,000th of the time of the previous one. And so that's accelerating really quick. The next one in the sequence would be 5 years. And so I do not think in 5 years, there's going to be enough change that would, equivalent to what have been in one of those earlier periods. Although the technological singularity people like Ray Kurzweil and John Smart kind of believe that that's going to be true. So it's just a geometric sequence of shorter and shorter times, faster and faster paces. That eventually leads to a specific time. And it's different than an exponential growth. Exponential growth, you can think of that doubling every certain period of time. With the singularity trend, it doubles kind of like every, half the time to a certain point. You can kind of see this in the population, global population of the Earth. A lot of people did estimates of that. And in 1960, there was Van Forrester kind of looked at the population trend, and he saw that it had a singularity trend, not just an exponential trend. And so he predicted doomsday in Nature magazine journal. That it would be November 26, 2026. So we have a couple years left. Obviously, he did not mean that it was going to be doomsday, but it just with the trend that it was going, right? And that trend broke around 1970, right? So we're not, population not following that trend anymore. So the idea is that, things have been, accelerating, kind of like the population, but just like that population trend, it'll eventually probably slow down and move into something else. So it's a singularity trend that usually focus on the greater, acceleration. But it, myself and many other people believe that, it will never come about, just like Van Forster never really thought that the population trend would go to infinity. Thank you.
Yeah, bringing in my historian training about how so much contingency goes into how different processes and events go into play. And sometimes you can't even really predict that ahead of time. It's just there's so many different variables.
Yes, it's kind of a great experiment. And we don't know the results yet of that experiment. We're kind of in the middle of it right now.
Now, how can geography, and we're kind of getting back onto Earth here, how can geography be interpreted within big history? You kind of talk about different patterns that emerge from the study of geography from a big history perspective.
Yeah, beginning of the book, I just wanted to kind of throw in different ways of looking at things. And so there's definitely various people that have done contributed to that. One is Jared Diamond, Germs, Guns, and Steel book, where he looked at the layout kind of continents, kind of horizontal or vertical, north, south, or east, west. And one of the main things there is the propagation of germs and domesticated animals, you know, prefers the ones where it's horizontal. You can go around climate zones and evolve that way. Versus, you know, Africa and the Americas, which are a lot north-south, and there's various barriers in between, kind of between domestic animals or germs, and so that's much tougher to be compatible with and grow in there. There's also been other studies of various, for example, fractal coastlines. One of the hypotheses is that, for example, Europe has a very highly irregular coastline in there, which kind of helped kind of keep it a little bit, you know, separate, not unifying, as opposed to, you know, someplace like China, which had, you know, one coastline, but a large interior plain. And so that tended to more unify. There's definitely a lot of, you know, dynasties and movement in there, but it does not have the irregularity of Europe, which really kept, you know, them from integrating into one country and kept competition kind of moving. And so I kind of look at, you know, what one of the things that I had looked at that was mentioned by Jack Goldstone is in his book, Why Europe. It's a big question of why did the kind of Industrial Revolution take off in Europe or Western Europe, while most of the technologies had been kind of invented elsewhere, including China, in terms of, you know, paper and steel, a lot of other things, gunpowder in there. And so, you know, that's a big question. And he pointed to the fact that, you know, it kind of came together in England, the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, with kind of a mix of society that was kind of ready for it and kind of integrated. There was the, you know, investors, the scientists, the technicians that really kind of met and discussed things. And the innovations were coming in quick enough so that it kind of created a positive feedback in there. And, you know, the development of the steam engine, James Watt, is definitely one of this combination of knowing people who knew the science, the technology, and the machining of it, but also the people who would invest in it and the people who knew what kind of problems could be solved with it. It was a big kind of feedback mechanism and to kind of get that going. That's good. Thank you.
Yep. Now, you also talk about different patterns in time. And one example you give is geometric timescales. Can you explain that for our listeners?
Yes. So this pattern of acceleration, you can think of, you know, the geometric timescales I already mentioned, the 5 billion, 5 million, 5,000 years. And so when I teach a short course on big history, you know, I like to make that relevant. And you can think of kind of a human life, an individual, each individual. We have kind of a geometric time scale kind of expanding. If you look at the development time, pregnancy, 9 months, and then multiply that by three, go to about, you know, 1 year, 1.5 years, where you're walking and talking, somewhat independent. Another factor of three on that, you're in beginning a formal school, socialization. Another factor of three, you're at kind of the end of high school, kind of entering adulthood there. Another factor of three is the working life, you know, kind of from 20 to 60. And you know, obviously, each one of those boundaries is flexible, right? So it's just kind of an example of how to think of an individual life on a log scale. And so a lot of people say, unfortunately, it doesn't extend for another factor of three after you retire. But people are working on that. But I think that is a good example of kind of tying a geometric time scale to someone's view of their life or someone else's life, and then can project that and see how things might have, how that applies to a larger time scale of big history. Thank you.
Yeah. Now, getting slightly back to the singularity question, you talk about different growth patterns, and let's talk about each one. You did mention one, exponential, briefly. Can you go into a little more detail about that, or do you have any more thoughts on that?
Yeah, so exponential is the easiest example is interest on money in a bank, right? And so that will double, for a given interest rate, right? It will double for a certain period of time. So for example, if you have 10% interest, it'll double every 7 years, kind of. And so that's quite a, simple to think about if you invest your money and kind of think about the future or you pay a mortgage type of thing. And so exponential is just that the growth rate is proportional to what's there, right? The amount of interest you get is proportional to the amount of money you have, right? And so that continues to grow. The hyperbolic or this geometric sequence is very closely related to an exponential in terms of the math, but a tremendously different type of behavior. And I think that's what's very interesting in this. And in fact, this was pointed out in the 1970s by Manfred Eigen, who had been involved in looking at biology and evolution. I believe he received the Nobel Prize in chemistry. He said in evolution, the rate of growth is not just in terms, general, and is not just proportional to what's there, but is proportional to the amount of learning that has occurred up to that time, which is proportional to kind of the current size. He said the growth is pretty proportional to the square of the amount of people or organisms. You can think of a hyperbolic bank, which I made an analogy, that would be where the interest that you get is proportional to the square of the amount of money that you currently have. And at first, it's very, very slow. And in fact, in the example that I had, if you invest in this bank, you really get bad returns until the last day, the last 2 days, where it pretty much goes to infinity. And obviously, the bank would go bankrupt on that day. So I'm not sure if I would actually invest in a hyperbolic bank. Thank you.
Now, probably the most common or the most basic growth pattern is linear, I believe. That's what you described?
Yes. A linear growth would just be, something proportional to the amount of the time that you have. Any of these curves, if you look at small enough segments, are going to look linear. Just kind of things, growing with linear, with time, every 2 years it grows, so much independent of what's there. We can look at growth in plants or various companies maybe of a linear growth, a certain number of growth inches or money or whatever per time. So it's very kind of straightforward, not too exciting in there, but very good. So one of the things that makes it a little bit different when you think about things is that these linear growths, usually over a long period of time, demonstrate some other characteristics. For example, if you look at the movement or the transmission of gossip, you know, first one person tells another person. And so you might think that would be linear, you know, the next person tells another person and so on. So that would be, you know, more linear growth. The number of people that know a piece of information would just be proportional to the time. However, you know, if one person tells, you know, a couple people, and those couple people tell, you know, two others, now you're at four, and then the next stage you're at eight. Well, now you're beginning to go at an exponential rate, right? For every single time step, you know, the number of people that would know would double. But eventually, you know, gossip only goes within a certain amount of crowd, a finite crowd size. So eventually it would kind of reach a saturation point, right, where someone would tell two people and one of those two people would say, well, I already know that, right? So it's nobody really new. So that kind of stops the exponential growth. And then eventually, you know, people would start telling their two people, and both of them would say, we already know, there's no one else that everyone knows that, right? So completely saturated. So that's kind of like a logistic kind of growth pattern that's seen in you know, gossip or in market growth, where there's, you know, early on, you know, a company starts to grow kind of linearly and then kind of exponentially, and then they begin to see it kind of slowing down and eventually saturating as they kind of reach their market potential. And so, you know, a lot of these curves do show different behaviors if you look at them in different time scales. But a lot of people have looked at the logistic growth. There was Cesar Marchetti looked at a lot of these growth patterns in like the 70s, including some in the 80s. But he said, you know, it doesn't only apply to markets, but also to ideas that are out there and to technologies. For example, he looked at energy substitution. He looked at the efficiency of the steam engine as a function of time. And so that gave me the idea to think about the development of physics ideas. You know, how many discoveries were made a certain period? And so, again, that started out relatively slow, kind of with Galileo and Newton, you know, huge contributions, but they kind of laid the groundwork. But once the foundation was set, then people could build on that really quickly. And then it kind of saturated. They discovered that area, but they built new tools and they found new areas to explore, new niches to develop. And so the whole process of discovery of physics kind of went that way, you know, gravitation, mechanics first, and then, you know, more and more details as you get the electromagnetic effects and thermodynamics. And then it kind of reached its peak kind of in the 20s, 30s, 40s with quantum mechanics, relativity, and nuclear technologies or nuclear science kind of going in there. And so, you know, along the way, a lot of people predicted, you know, this is going to be the end of physics. You know, we know everything, you know, including at the end of the 19th century, there was a lot of people who thought that. And when, you know, that golden age was reached, they revitalized the whole physics and rewrote a lot of it. And then it kind of slowed down a little bit. You know, after that, there was a lot of particle physics, high energy physics that was looked at. And I started to go into that area. And it just really wasn't for me. There were, you know, the experiments are huge. And I had a hard time kind of in that environment. And I really appreciate the people that continue. But I worked on, you know, looking at detectors that would find the Higgs particle and modeled those before they were built. And that was in the early 1980s. And they didn't find it to 2012 after a few generations of particle detectors and accelerators. But I'm very glad that they continued to find that, whereas I went on to other things. Thank you.
Yeah. So these time patterns, they're not mutually exclusive. They actually work together and sometimes in parallel with each other.
Yes. So there are different timescales of things that happen. So sometimes you might see some cycling or some exponential growth as some new area is found. Then that might turn into logistic growth. And then looking at a larger scale, that logistic growth might just be one part of, you know, a larger type of growth. And so what we call is nested patterns. And so looking at physics, there were nested logistic transitions, logistic growth, right? One field would develop, gravitation and mechanics, but that would open up new fields for people to explore. So the transition occurred in one field, gravitation, but opened up another that then grew at a logistic. And then when you step back and take a look at the whole picture, you can see the overall logistic pattern of all those, you know, smaller timescale patterns in there. So nested patterns definitely is part of that. And also when you look at smaller scales, you can see various things in there. For example, in population, it looked like it was an exponential growth kind of in recent times. But if you step back, take a longer look at it, you can see that, yeah, it's just a sequence of exponentials that kind of more indicate that it's kind of this hyperbolic type of growth. Very good, thank you.
Yeah. Now, what is the theory of panarchy? You mentioned this in the book.
Yes, that is very good, and that really fits in here. There was a group, Holling was a part of that, and instead of a hierarchy, top-down type of approach, or, bottom-up, everything comes from the bottom and bubbles up. They looked at ecosystems, and they saw that information went both ways, right? From the large system to smaller scales, also from the smaller scales up above, and kind of all these, interacting systems, right? A very complex system of interacting parts at multiple scales, from the ecosystem to the organism to the cells and bacteria and decomposers, and also different time scales. And so each one of those kind of, operates somewhat independently, but it has contact with the higher and lower levels. And so those will undergo kind of somewhat cycles of finding, new opportunities to grow. It will grow in there until it reaches kind of this saturation. Maybe it'll grow such that it overuses the resources. And if it overuses the resources, it will eventually collapse, releasing the resources for, higher and lower levels to use. And then it might reorganize and find a new way to grow and repeat the cycle. And so this occurs at the many levels. Ecosystems have their own life. After a fire, they will, start at a basic level and then mature. But they have enough, ecosystems have enough feedback generally so that they will not overshoot, right? There's positive feedback to begin with to continue the growth. But then there's some negative feedback, right? So that they don't overgrow. And so they can evolve or develop into this mature system. Thank you.
Yeah, this actually reminds me of the field of morphogenesis, and especially in the social and historical sciences, they talk about that, like how societies have different levels and there's different dynamics, like the whole structure and agency debate, but it's like how they fluctuate between each other on different levels of society and all that. And I believe it was also modeled off biological research, Margaret Archer. It was really fascinating what you were talking about there. It reminded me of.
Yeah. I just remember Gunderson was the other person kind of with Holland in Panarchy. And they did look at, you know, they discovered this in ecosystems and then looked at the broader picture and say, yeah, you know, this is kind of what goes in various complex systems, right? And so one of the things that I tried to look at in the book early was, you know, kind of how does this apply to an individual and then kind of, you know, work up to larger levels. So I looked at kind of the resting patterns, right? It's kind of our ability to, you know, after some growth and learning, you know, take a little bit of a break and figure out what's going on and integrate it into the rest of us, you know, integrate that information and then move on, you know, figure out if there's a better way of going and at different time scales. So I started with, you know, a day. And obviously we have, you know, one third of our day pretty much is this resting period, which is, you know, quite long considering, you know, all the other time we really want to crunch as much in there. But it's really is required, right, to integrate all that information and recover. And so it's kind of in that panarchy cycle, right? We learn during the day, we grow, you know, we use our resources of our body, you know, we replenish with food and then we replenish, you know, with sleep and we're ready to go the next day, most of the times at least. And then there are other periods, for example, in the work week, right? We work generally 5 days out of seven, and then 2 days kind of not on a network. I mean, we could do other types of work, but kind of hopefully more refreshing, recreational hobbies or whatever. And so that again is, you know, you don't want to have something that just stresses out all the time, right? We want that capability of, you know, looking back, seeing if things are going okay, and dropping things if things are not going the way that we're looking. So then that continues in terms of the seasonal kind of holidays, you know, years taking vacation, you know, changes in life in terms of jobs or relationships. And that kind of covers, you know, the life cycle. Then the question was, well, does that continue into, you know, society, kind of like as you say? And so we looked at some of the cycles in there. And there was one in a book by Peter Turchin who looked at this predator-prey model. And you might think, why talk about predator prey when we talk about individuals and resting and civilizations? But, you know, those are ecosystems, again, that do show these oscillations. And if you have, for example, rabbits and foxes in there, and so the rabbits eat the grass and the foxes eat the rabbits, there might be an equilibrium where there's a certain amount of rabbits that eat the grass and take all that resources, and the foxes then eat, you know, sustainably eat the rabbits. But usually it's not in equilibrium. And if it's not, it will go through these cycles over time where foxes might increase and get too many, so they die off, and the rabbits, you know, increase. And so that cycle time is kind of related to the birth and the death rate of the rabbits and the foxes. And so he just kind of applied it. Well, what if you put in, you know, human birth rates and death rates, which, you know, pretty much the same. He came up with kind of a period around 375, 400 years or something like that. And there are, you know, indications that, you know, that is somewhat of a typical long range kind of dynasty or civilization lifetime. It's not exactly, you know, clear. There's no, you know, clear definitive relationship or model for that. He did create a model and kind of exploring that. So at first it was just to recognize that this might be, so it's a hypothesis, and he made a model. And kind of one of the things he was kind of indicating is that, you know, there's two groups of people that he put in, kind of the workers and the elites. you know, kind of there's a trade-off between them, and eventually the elites might gather, you know, a lot of the resources, and with some delays in there of the consequences of that, the workers might not, you know, thrive as much. And so there, this gets out of equilibrium and kind of continues this cycle. So I think there's, you know, a lot of these models, like you say, that look at what might be going on in civilizations or societies or smaller groups. And a lot of the ideas, you know, came from, you know, ecosystem modeling, where they could actually, you know, make some of these measurements. Thank you.
Now, what are Kondratiev waves? I've heard this term several times before in the big history field, and you talk about this in the book.
Yes. He was a Russian, I believe in the early 20s, kind of looking at business cycles, and kind of in the 60 to 70 year range. It seems to be tied to the introduction and development of new technologies. And so the idea is that when things kind of slow down in business, you know, people are beginning to think about other ways of doing things, and some science might be coming up. They might develop it in a new technology, and it takes a while to do that. And then once, you know, it takes like a shakeout period, right, to figure out what technologies are going to survive and work. But once that has been kind of established, well, then, you know, on the logistic curve, then you can, you know, quickly kind of grow until it gets to a saturation. So it's kind of related to a business cycle logistic growth pattern, just of general groups of technologies. And so that's in the, there are other cycle periods and different names for waves, but this one is kind of in the 60 to 70 year period. Somewhat of a, you know, a full generation, human lifetime type. And I know others have kind of taken a look at that. The one thing that I looked at was in the U.S. history, you know, there was, you know, very short cycle. If you look at since World War II, there was a, you know, oscillation between Democrats and Republicans that has been, the pattern has been broken twice now. And when I wrote the book, it was only broken once, but it used to be two terms of Democrats and two terms of Republicans, you know, from Truman all the way through Obama. The one period that was different was the 1980 election with Carter and Reagan, but it then resumed because there was 4 years Democrat and 12 years Republican. So it went back on schedule and worked. And so right now we are in one of those strange times. The 2020 election was one that kind of broke that pattern, maybe indicating something's going on. But so that was a 16-year cycle. And then I looked back, you know, take a step back. And so that was while the U.S. was kind of in a global leadership role, kind of after World War II. But asked then, you know, when were the, you know, kind of the, what are regarded as the important presidents in the U.S. history? And so it kind of went, you know, Washington, Lincoln, and Roosevelt, FDR with, you know, Theodore Roosevelt in between, and Jackson kind of in there. And kind of the periods between Washington, Lincoln, and FDR, kind of that 72-year period. And so I looked at the rankings of the presidents from historians, and I know that changes over time, right? Presidents' regard kind of increases and decreases as historians see, you know, what the impact was, right? And it's not clear right after that they're done. The presidents are done. And so the historians kind of look at the big picture of that. And so, you know, it might be a 72-year kind of political history in there. And the U.S. has definitely gone through a major growth phase, right? It wasn't, you know, a country that was there to begin with. And so it did go through growth phases. And so I kind of went through, you know, kind of what those growth phases might be. Thank you.
Yeah, and you also did some interesting thoughts along those lines with Russian and Chinese history as well in the book. Now, what kind of cycles and dynamics do religions and worldviews experience? And you did mention this earlier in the interview.
There's Graves, Clark Graves, had started kind of looking into this, and Cesar Marchetti had also looked at waves in religions, specifically Catholicism, but Graves kind of looked further back and kind of, you know, eventually it was made into like this color, color code of history of religion, but kind of a oscillation between kind of an individual view to a larger view, and kind of the dynamics of, you know, individualization and understanding of the world that's out there. And so we can see that, you know, that interpretation is that the religion evolved kind of with, you know, some of the technology and our understanding. And that makes sense. I mean, the religion is, you know, like historically is one way we could kind of make sense of things that you really don't understand. And a common view, right, that allows civilizations to operate together, right? If everyone has a different view, you know, in the U.S., we say that's okay. But if you're a country, you know, in the middle of, you know, people trying to attack you or whatever, you know, it's good to have, you know, a common viewpoint. And in the U.S., the common viewpoint is kind of like the Constitution and the ability to have different views, right? So it's a different level of a common view, I hope. But so, you know, religion kind of went along with that. You can see different parts kind of evolving over time. I think that, you know, the more recent, you know, times, you know, religion was kind of, you know, a lot of people say religion was, you know, the filling in the gaps of the scientific understanding. And so those gaps seem to be, you know, closing in as science found more and more. And I think in the, you know, the 70s or close there, you know, Steven Weinberg, kind of in his book, First 3 Minutes, said that the more we understand the universe, the more it seems pointless. And I think, you know, that view has been kind of changing because we do understand that our scientific understanding is only just a minor part right now. There's a lot of uncertainty in there. And we haven't, you know, there's a lot to discover yet. And so I started reading a book by Bobby Azarian, who's a neuroscientist, and kind of, you know, articulating this viewpoint that, you know, when we take a look at it, it ties back to big history in that, you know, life might not just be one random, you know, accident. It might be, you know, somewhat in the laws of physics. And people usually say that the second law of thermodynamics, that entropy always increases, is contradictory to the origin and development of life, right? That was the viewpoint, at least at that era early on. And people made progress kind of in that, in saying that, well, you know, you look at some of these phenomena, tornadoes, hurricanes that occur naturally, they self-organize, and they self-organize to make sure that entropy increases the, you know, fastest, right? It's the way to really get rid of that energy gradient of the heat in the, either in the ocean or in the air. And so other people have taken this, including Nick Lane, has been studying the origin of life quite a bit and the metabolism in that. And the fact that the second law, you know, maybe does not preclude life and formation of patterns, but also might help establish it, that the second law and its sequence not only does entropy in disorder kind of increase over time, but nature does not like those gradients. And so it will work kind of quickly, just even have some self-organization to create entropy as, at a faster and faster rate. And, you know, I've had various discussions on this. We're definitely proving that as humans today, you know, using all this oil and fossil fuels that have been around for millions of years, and we're using it at a very good rate right now. So, you know, even now, kind of the views of, you know, where we fit and where life fits kind of in the universe is you know, having some dynamics and obviously, you know, be very good to see some evidence somewhere, and people have done some lab experiments, but really be good to, you know, see something out there that's where it happened also. Thank you.
Yeah, this has been a real fascinating discussion. Now, how does like big history, or at least your approach to big history, approach some of like the major transitions in history? And especially I'd like to get to like the rise of agriculture and the transition to civilization as you describe it in the book.
Yes. And so we look at the civil development of civilization. And so this was one of the early parts, because history is pretty much well documented. Maybe people have, you know, arguments on that, but if you look at the history of human evolution, you're working with a couple bones and skulls and skeletons, and the real, you know, dynamics was kind of the development of the brain, and we don't have a good understanding even of what's, you know, here now, very much less how it evolved, right? So that whole human evolution, not as well, you know, documented. Evolution of life, you know, somewhat. I mean, we have DNA, and there's been a lot of good information come from that. But historically, we have people's writings, and that's not always the most accurate thing. But we also have ways of testing some of those with dating and artifacts and so on. And so that continues. And so I looked at there is some data to take a look at. So I looked at the, you know, ancient and classical civilizations and kind of picked the leading edge, kind of the one most advanced one. Some people have looked at the whole group, and I say, you know, focus in on the leading edge, because that's what a lot of big history does, looks at the leading edge of the complexity. And so I looked at the, you know, the period at which that civilization was kind of in the lead. And so, you know, kind of starts out, you can either go to Egypt or Mesopotamia, but that's kind of what I focused on. You know, some of the early civilizations did last kind of for a long time there. They had kind of stable technology. They had agriculture, and they're kind of figuring out how to work that in. Iron and the horse kind of introduced a lot of more warfare and competition, and that kind of sped things up. And so around 600 BC or so, there was kind of a rapid turnover of the leadership in civilization as those new technologies entered, and then people figured out what to do. And so the lifetime started increasing of those, eventually leading to Rome, which did not do a whole lot in terms of innovating technology. I mean, they put a lot of use in terms of cement in buildings and so on, but they mostly applied the technology that they had to really expand, and that expansion was kind of crucial because in the big cities in Rome, it's not too stable, right? And when you have the large cities, the problem is, well, you have disease, you have waste in there, you're going to have conflicts. And so kind of in the cities, it had to be supported by people coming in from the outside. And so I took a look at, that was a transition that I could somewhat quantitatively take a look at. So again, it's this S curve or logistic kind of transition. And so you can identify the midpoint and the width of that. And so then I created some phenomenological models, pretty much just system dynamics models of the major features of what's going on, right? And so in the civilization, it was kind of, you're going to have this hierarchy to support the insurance that you're going to have, stores of food if something happens, or also militarily, are you going to have the ability to withstand some, attack from outside? And that really kind of, accelerates a lot of the changes. And so I also mentioned Peter Turchin, who has various models in this, and his book Ultra Society, he talks about when the civilization formed, it caused that ultra society, as opposed to early on, where humans were in small groups and kind of knew each other and who they work with. You go into a larger civilization, you don't know everybody that you really have to interact with. So you have to have trust and have people proxies that will negotiate kind of for you in a large, hierarchy that can organize that part. And so he's done quite a bit of work on that also. So then I took a look at the other transitions that might have occurred after, that ancient and classical civilization in terms of kind of the Middle Ages and then the development kind of after the modern era. 1500 on, where things kind of sped up again, right? In terms of the scientific revolutions and explorations, really to find new things. And then, industrial revolution, a little bit later. It took a while to figure out some of these things. And, textiles and agriculture were some of the early implementations of the technology, but it was kind of the steam engine that really created this, this cycle, positive cycle of the feedback that really led to rapid growth. So I took a look at each one of those, is trying to figure out what might be going on. And I mentioned the one about, the Industrial Revolution of, the inventions coming from other places, including China, coming within a shorter amount of time, and really creating a critical rate of innovation, of breaking things, right? And so we have that today, right? People want to break things and create some new thing, creative destruction type of thing, Schumpeter kind of said. And if that happens, slowly, one innovation might break things, you might put things together, and then you kind of lose that momentum. And so that might have been what was happening. Hopefully, we don't break everything all at the same time. And that's what I'm kind of worried about, is if we continue this acceleration, that's what's, you know, going to happen. I've been in, you know, developing software for some of the environmental tools, and just rapid change. And rapid change leads to things just breaking down. It's a continual battle to keep things maintained and working. And so I think, you know, in terms of life, there's various stresses, right, as you age and develop and find things out. But also change itself kind of adds a big stress to life and just in general, right? A lot of people say change is good. Well, yeah, to a point. And Tainter had a book on collapse of civilizations in which or societies in which he looked at complexity can be good to some point, but eventually there's a marginal benefit of complexity, right? You don't want to make it too complex, right, where things just start to collapse. And so I think we're, you know, somewhere close there right now. I know in the IT business, I think it has slowed down a little bit. Things not breaking as much as they had been. Thank you.
Yeah, and kind of building off that last discussion, you talk about complex adaptive systems and system sciences through the book. Can you kind of explain that for our listeners who might not be as familiar with that terminology? But that, I know that's a real growing field right now.
Yes. Complex adaptive systems. So systems, which means a lot of interacting parts with different functions. So, you know, a body is a system, civilization is a system, a cell is a system. And complex, meaning they have a lot of different parts, a lot of different interactions. And adaptive would mean that it has a capability of learning and storing that information and passing that information on. And that's one of the keys. Each part of the system, there's called agents or, you know, people or cells or, countries. And so they all interact. You know, complexity is very difficult to actually measure and somewhat define. But essentially, these complex adaptive systems, they kind of go with the panarchy model, different levels of scale in terms of time and spatial scale. But essentially, they do maintain their organization, right? That's one thing that they do, just like humans maintain their organization despite all the changes. And so in order to do that, they need some energy flow, right? We need some food. Civilization needs its oil and electricity type of thing. Cells need their sugars. And so energy is necessary, but it's not sufficient, right? If you just throw some energy at something, it's not going to necessarily spontaneously go into a self-maintaining system. So you need some information maintenance, right? You need to know what it is that you need, what organization do you need to maintain? And if something goes out of whack, you need to know how to maintain that, either get rid of it or fix it or whatever, right? So need some information. So in the cell, you know, you can think of it as the DNA there in response to various things, the various repair mechanisms. Humans, have various systems, but including the brain, kind of on a conscious level when things go wrong. And societies have their various organizations that hopefully, you know, keep track of things also. I mean, it's just besides the government, there's obviously markets and organizations and legal organizations out there. And so also has to maintain an organization within inside the environment that it currently is at, right? And so it has to compete maybe for resources, but obviously there's another way of obtaining resources, not just compete, but cooperate or collaborate. And so, you know, that has been, you know, a field of study that's definitely been looked at in biology, and Peter Turchin's Ultra Society, that's his main thing, is that we've learned to collaborate in these large organizations, right? And he said that one of the main mechanisms of inducing that collaboration is war. And so let's hope that it stops at some point. And I think we're getting there with, you know, the markets and collaborating on various ways also. So getting back to the point of complex adaptive systems, you know, they are at various scales. I think energy, information, the environment, and organization are four characteristics, and they usually have to be able to, you know, not only learn themselves, but be able to innovate also kind of evolve. And so a lot of people, you might have heard of complex adaptive systems modeling, and so people use that. I've used that for a couple things. I took, a course that they have at Santa Fe Institute. They have a lot of good things online for that. We have a big system that I worked on looking at COVID, where they had 3 million agents simulating each person in Chicago, and each person was given, you know, their schedule, right? So the question was, well, how is COVID going to diffuse through this environment, and what are some of the key parameters then to take a look at, and how good did that actually model, what actually happened? So I typically kind of look at complex adaptive systems kind of a model to use, not a computational model, although I have used that. It's just that some of those models are very difficult to track, right? If you knew everything of everyone in Chicago, or, you know, all the information about an agent, or if you looked at evolution, if you knew of every single organism, you still would not be able to really get a big picture of what's going on in there. And so that's why I like to start, you know, kind of at higher level models with a little bit of data, and then kind of hopefully move on to more specific, or better yet, find someone else who has done that research and then include it. So it's kind of building on others and it's just amazing what kind of studies that people have done and people have found and discovered. Always amazed by that. Thank you.
Yeah, the Santa Fe Institute, and also the New England Complex Systems Institute, I believe it's in New England, I know, are like the two main research institutes in the field of complexity studies. It's a real fascinating field, but of course, you know, if you want to give yourself a migraine, it can also give you that real quickly too.
Yes. There's also EvoDevo, Evolution Development Group, that a lot of Peter Corning lead in that is involved with. And so, yeah, there's, it just seems, these institutes study a large range of phenomena, right? Not just, you know, big history or evolution or so, but I mean, they look at what's currently going on and scaling of things in biology. And so very fascinating studies that can be kind of used or thought about and applied in other areas. Thanks.
Well, this has been a very, very fascinating discussion. I'm sure we could continue for hours on end about this, and no doubt we will be, especially at the big history conferences, no doubt. Do you have any final thoughts? Maybe touch on anything in the book that weren't able to get to in the interview?
Yeah, one thing that was the metaphor. I've been trying to figure out, you know, how to, you know, kind of convey some of these messages or whatever. So one thing I tried was the metaphor of, you know, rocketing something into orbit. And I think, you know, if people understand a rocket, it has a finite amount of fuel, and it has to get up into orbit at a certain speed. And once it's there, it is stable. It doesn't need any more, you know, energy to move, right? It's self-sustaining. And, this is kind of what we have currently. We have this fossil fuel. It's kind of a gift from the past, right? We're using it. Hopefully we're using it to understand where we are and how we can, you know, get to that next level of technology so that we're sustainable, right? And then once we're in, you know, that sustainability, well, then, you know, we're free to think of other things, just like, you know, the rocket in the orbit, it's free to do other things there. It doesn't have to worry about, you know, the energy for the motion. So if anybody has any ideas of how to convey these ideas better or get them out, that'd be great. I'd love to hear from anybody who has any feedback on this. Thank you. I really appreciate the opportunity to discuss this with you. Very nice.
Yes, it was a great pleasure on my part as well. We usually like to end our interviews by asking our guests, what are you working on now?
That's a good question. So there's a lot of, I found out when I gave a talk at Big History, I was kind of thinking that people had, you know, taken into account, you know, some of these ways of looking at this acceleration. And I had to take a step back because I got a little bit of feedback on that. And it was good. It was good for me to take a step back, actually put it together and kind of take a look at what others had done and to document that and continually have debates about this. But also, you know, I'd want to move forward on that by, looking more quantitatively at the energy flow at each of these stages. And I know that's going to be, you know, somewhat difficult to kind of estimate these things. And so I think, you know, that is what I'm kind of looking at. I'm trying to think about another book. Kind of, you know, there's been a lot of books on Big History narrative, you know, just kind of going from the Big Bang to current day and then the future, but not a whole lot kind of on, you know, some of these patterns that are out there and what's driving it. So what I call, you know, what else is there in terms of, you know, building it up, building the models, you know, what are the evidence for the models? And, you know, what is the meaning of this? And of course, it's very speculative in terms of the meaning. So I think there's a gap there. I'm not really too sure, but I'm having fun putting that together. So hopefully stay tuned. We'll see what comes of that.
Well, maybe when you finish some of that work, we could have you back on the podcast and we can talk about it further.
All right. Very good.
Dave Lepore, thank you for joining us on the New Books Network.
All right. Well, thank you very much. Hopefully see you later.
Okay. Thank you for listening to this episode of the New Books Network. I am your host, Stephen Sakevich. Until next time.